to the Semiconductor Insiders Podcast Series. The goal of this podcast is to bring semiconductor experts together to get to the truth about the matter at hand. We'll get right to the point and not exceed 30 minutes of your time. If you have a topic you would like us to cover, please post it on semiwiki.com and we'll get right to it.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I welcome you to this webinar that we're hosting, co-hosting with SemiWiki and Silicon Catalyst to address the challenges and issues associated with silicon IP selection for early stage semiconductor companies. I'm going to hand the mic over to Daniel and he'll go and walk through the rest of the panel session. Thank you for your attendance.
Thank you, Richard. Today's discussion is around the requirements and challenges of investigation and ultimate selection of IP for early stage chip companies, discussing both the technical and business aspects of securing IP for your designs. IP is a big topic. It's one of the biggest trending topics on SemiWiki. It has been for the last 10 years. It is really a cornerstone of the fabless semiconductor ecosystem. So this should be a good discussion. With us today are three CEOs that are inside the incubator: Jyothi Rosenberg from Dover Microsystems, John Terry from Esprit Technologies, and Faraz Mubarak from Spark Microsystems. So first we'll have a couple introductory questions and then we'll get down to the IP part. So please introduce yourself and your company. What problems are you addressing? Let's start with Jyothi.
Okay, thank you. Hi, I'm Jyothi Rosenberg, the founder and CEO of Dover Microsystems. There is, I think probably everybody who reads the news knows that cybersecurity attacks are a huge problem. And there are 3,000 software vendors that are calling themselves cybersecurity defense systems. And yet the number of attacks and the severity of attacks continues to go up. And so the problem we're trying to solve is turning this around. And we're doing that by getting into the hardware where you're not subvertible over the network, and then trying to make the processors that are in all of these devices essentially immune to the cyber attacks. We've been part of Silicon Catalyst since November of 2019. And we're a little bit different than a lot of the other companies in because we are actually an IP provider ourselves. So some of the issues we have are slightly different, but I think that'll make this more interesting. What we've gotten out of the Silicon Catalyst relationship is a tremendous amount of support from the ecosystem, from the set of advisors that Silicon Catalyst has attracted and continues to attract more. And these are folks that have helped us in a number of areas, new leads, getting into companies at the right level, and advice in general. The biggest challenge for us is that, well, first of all, we've solved a problem because we have this, great research background from DARPA, but people don't know that what we're doing is actually possible. And we have to get into the silicon providers. And, these are huge companies, slow to make decisions. So, it's been challenging to get to the point where folks like, the big chip companies and the device manufacturers understand this is possible and to adopt it. So I think that's really been, in a nutshell, our biggest challenge.
Great answers. John, can you go next?
Sure. John Terry, CEO of Esprit Technologies. At Esprit, we're developing an encapsulation waveform technology that provides security for both the battlefield of things and the internet of things. And what we've been facing since our inception is moving from the prototype solutions into silicon. And one of the reasons why we joined the Silicon Catalyst family was to help with that process. And we've been in Silicon Catalyst since 2018. And over the 24 months that we've been there, we have seen a lot of exposure from the semiconductor industry. It hasn't yet translated into revenue, but it has created openings for us to explore in the future once we have our silicon completed. So some of the challenges have been, as we Jockey talked about, is that you have to have something for these big vendors to, and these big companies to know exactly what you can offer for them. And getting our solution into silicon has been somewhat of a challenge, primarily not the fundraising aspect, because then VCs want to see the customer engagement and customers want to see the product. And so until we can break through to that waterlog, we've been primarily using grant funding to move our technology along. And it's been a little bit challenging because that, you know, that source of revenue isn't sufficient to get us an ASIC. So we're looking forward to continuing this process through the Silicon Catalyst In-Kind Partners program and using that as a way forward for our solution to get into the marketplace.
Excellent. How about you, Ferris? You're on mute.
Hi. Thank you, Daniel, and thank you, everyone. Spark Microsystems is in the connectivity business. With the explosion of IoT and wireless connectivity happening around the world, there is a clear need in being able to provide a wireless connectivity solution that bridges high data rate, ultra low power, ultra low latency, and be able to do some indoor positioning better than existing technologies, whether they're Bluetooth, Bluetooth low energy, Zigbee, Z-Wave, can do. This ensemble of best of both worlds of connectivity and ranging is needed. There was a partial solution a year and a half ago introduced by Apple with the U1 chip in their phone, but that's only a partial solution. It gives accurate ranging, but it's still high power and it's not suitable yet. The standards are not. Does is order magnitude better power, latency, and higher data rate, as well as ranging compared to the other narrowband and Bluetooth standards and ultra wideband standards. Spark started as university research in about 10 years ago in 2010, incorporated in 2016 and joined the Silicon Catalyst Incubator at the end of 2016. The seed round did not come until end of 2017, which is when I joined the company. And then now, our first product is in production. We started to have some revenue coming from strategic customer prototyping and evaluating our solutions, as well as vertical markets using us in pre-production applications and ramping up. We joined the incubator in 2016, and we were blessed. We were unique in that capacity is that Silicon Catalyst agreed to extend us twice. So we spent 4 years in the incubator and we graduated last December. I would say Spark has leveraged every possible benefit that could come from Silicon Catalyst. And for that, we are very grateful. I was hired as an industry CEO through the advisors from Silicon Catalyst. Some of the investors came from Silicon Catalyst, and certainly all of the in-kind partners that we could have used, from Synopsys to Arm to TSMC to Advantest, we have leveraged. And all of that translates in us raising a little over $1 million in seed funding, and with that, being able to produce a production mass set that went to market. That's unheard of in the semiconductor industry. And Silicon Catalyst played a big role in that. Our biggest challenge is twofold. One, when you offer something that versatile, you're not a standard. Hardly ever any innovation comes out of that magnitude that is the standard. We're not. And that presents its own challenges, number one. And number two, as you go after different verticals, the needs that need to be around the transceiver market are varied and require IP, require integration. Thus comes the IP challenge. We are experts in radio frequency. We cannot do everything else. So we got to have the runway to run, but also we have to partner with the right IP vendors, with the right design houses to do variations on our product, you know, going forward and not have to rebuild everything from scratch internally. Thank you.
Great. So let's talk about IP. You know, I've been in the industry over 30 years, and a lot of that has been in IP. You know, we used to develop it internally, and then we went commercial. It's a big challenge today. There's a lot of alternatives, and you have to investigate, you have to evaluate, you have to integrate, you have to verify. It's a big challenge, especially for emerging companies. So let's start with you again, Jyothi. Talk about your IP process and your decisions and how you came about where you are today.
So, our decisions are a little bit, have to be a little different than what you're going to get from other folks who are making an ASIC. We're being brought into an SoC builder, you know, like NXP, who is our sort of flagship customer, and there's a decision we have to make, which is, well, how do we integrate with the processor core IP they've chosen? So they've made the decision. In their case, it was the first thing we worked on with them was a Cortex M7 from ARM, and now they're going to put us up against a different ARM core, and so we have to integrate with that core, which is a pretty tight integration. We look at every instruction that processor is executing. So we've got to get the instruction out of the processor into our IP, which is sitting right next to it. But that's really the main decision that we have to make, is how do we integrate with the IP cores that our customers have chosen?
Okay, so the selection process is made for you. Got it.
Yeah.
You know, selecting IP can, you know, make or break your company. John, can you talk to us about how you selected your IP?
Yes, Daniel. So, you know, for our cases, it's slightly different in that, you know, primarily our team are algorithm developers. So we're experts in DSP processing and signal processing and communications theory. And our design flow requires extensive modeling in MATLAB and simulating, and then we move those designs onto software-defined radio platforms. And primarily, no matter what vendor you select, ARM is the processor of choice on those software-defined radios. So the instruction sets and the source code that we've developed with our prototype solutions, we wanted those to translate into the ASIC solution. So ARM was a natural selection for us for building an SoC design based on our digital IP. And so we have two different products that are scheduled to launch in the next 12 months. One is leveraging the Cortex M3, which is for our edge devices. And then we have a gateway device where we're using the A53, where that we're looking to provide the ability of our customers to do some programming in a SDK so that they can reconfigure our chipset to their particular application. So ARM became a natural selection for us based on our history with doing top-down designs through software EDA tools such as MathWorks and Simulink. So that's how, you know, we really focused in on ARM, because we wanted to reuse that code as much as possible. And they have a lot of other, the Flexible Access Program have a lot of other unique processors that's geared around machine learning. And these are some of the aspects that we've added to our core technology. So that was a further bonus for us.
So you mentioned flexible access. Can you expand on that a little bit? What is that and how did that help you?
Right, so flexible access is a new approach that ARM is trying to bring their capabilities to small companies. And for a modest price, considering for what the the access to the different IP cores that you get, you can develop models, and you can develop your technology, and you can do prototype shuttles, and you don't start paying royalty until you go into production. So that frees you up from worrying about paying these exorbitant licensing fees in the early stages of your company, and you can then amortize those costs through your customer revenue later on.
Oh, excellent. Faraz, can you expand on that? How did you guys select your IP, and you know what experience did you have?
Yeah, time to market is everything. So we have to pick something that'll get us quickly to market. And then there are two classes of IP. There is IP that is customer facing, like application MCUs or processors, and we'll talk about ARM in a second, or there is internal IP for our transceiver to function. So you have outside facing versus internal IP, and then you have process technology nodes where in the spirit of time to market, you have to find it. Anything that's not outside facing, that's internal uses only, we selected it around the needs for our foundry, for our process, and we went to multiple sources to select that IP, including our foundry, TSMC. Anything that's outside facing, well, processors, for example, MCUs, well, clearly we're a non-standard radio. And as John just said, ARM is the standard out there. The last thing we want is to put a non-standard kind of MCU next to a non-standard radio. So to us, it was pretty important to use MCU or processing power in the future that our customers can easily port their applications to. Now, there may be IP which is not MCU related for vertical markets like audio IP, and Silicon Catalyst has a wealth of partners as well that we're talking to in order to select some IP that can be used to bring up our vertical solutions and reference designs. The flexible access program, as John very well described, was very, very important to us. Otherwise, it would have been prohibitive. We don't know yet if we want to use an M33 or an M4 or an M3 or an M0 for internal housekeeping. We have a lot of things we want to try, and the flexible access program gives you a vast amount of processors and MCU subsystems and peripherals that you can use. Synopsys is another partner that does peripherals for the ARM IP that we are talking to. And the flexible access program enabled us to decide and save the valuable cash for the license fee to when you're ready to do a production tape out, not at this early stage.
Yeah, you know, nobody mentioned the word ecosystem, but you're kind of describing it. You know, the foundry ecosystem is important in getting your chips through, you know, the manufacturing process. But you also mentioned maybe not specifically, but the ARM ecosystem. So how has the ARM ecosystem helped you guys? Jonathan, can you mention, can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, yeah, and I was going to, and part of that is I'm going to say some more about the flexible access program as part of this. The thing that's been just amazing to me is that, you know, the liaison between ARM and Silicon Catalyst, a gentleman named Mark Lewin, is he's figured out a way to make ARM feel like a small, intimate company, because we've needed, you know, a lot of heavy lifting from some of the engineering teams to be able to integrate with these cores. The rest of the ARM ecosystem is sort of sitting around, you know, what it is that we're building, and we're plugging into that pretty easily. They use standard compilers, and we support those compilers, and it's very easy for us to make sure that our tools work with the standard tool flow that that people use to develop their applications on ARM. So it's been a pretty easy road for us.
Yeah, how about you, John? Do you have further comments on the ecosystem that ARM provides? You're on mute.
Sorry about that. So other than the fact that, as Jessica was speaking, Mark has been very, very helpful in helping my team utilize all of the resources available that ARMA has provided through the Flexible Access Program. And we haven't had any problems that they haven't been more than willing to jump in and roll up the sleeves to help us along with. To that extent, you know, it's been a great a privilege because we had not had that experience before working with these hardened IP cores. All of our work to date had been working with the soft cores on the FPGA platforms. So the transition so far has been somewhat seamless, other than with a few hiccups. But every time we stumble, ARM was there to help us make progress past those minor limitations. But beyond that, it's been a fairly seamless process.
Yeah, Ferris, can you make a comment? You know, I'm also interested in finding out, for example, you mentioned ARM, you know, they're the leader. It choosing ARM, does that make it easier for you? I mean, finding people, finding tools, does your funding source recognize the ARM name?
Absolutely. I mean, thank you for bringing up the common denominator that underlines every IP, which is ecosystem. So that we refer to it, but we don't name it. It was easier. First of all, no matter what MCU or what processor you use, you're never going to get it 100% right. And you're never going to get it all the peripherals 100% right. So there's bound to be some customers who say, well, I want to port from this MCU to that MCU. Being on an ARM code base, our customers are very familiar with the application development environment, and it's easy for them to port to another MCU that's ARM-based, that's even in our current generation product where the MCU is external. Our investors certainly understand what we're doing in terms of minimizing the risk by adopting an application ecosystem which is well defined. Time to market, I mentioned, is very important to us, which is, I mean, even though digital subsystems are very common these days, for Spark, we're an RF and mixed signal house. This is not our forte. Finding the right design houses, finding the right IP, finding the right peripherals, much more easily and readily available. And it's been proven on the right process node with the right ARM MCU. We have been able to do that. And that was helpful. And certainly everybody's giving a shout out to Mark Lewin. I want to just do the same because he's been great and ARM has been great in really making it feel, in the 4 years we've spent at Silicon Catalyst, ARM was a big company that was difficult sometimes to figure out how we can find an easy way to work with them. And towards the end, they were this startup friendly company who was very, very able to be there, respond quickly, and meet pretty much all our needs without having to do a lot of negotiations, a lot of begging and a lot of things. We got what we need, you know. So that was huge. But yes, investors, consultants, IP sources, and customer porting and customer applications were all integral to that decision.
Yeah. You know, full disclosure, ARM's been a big part of the SemiWiki website since we started. IP is one of the top drivers. And of course, ARM is one of the top drivers in IP. And I also published a book on ARM. It's called Mobile Unleashed. It's the history of ARM and their top customers. And so I know probably more about ARM than most people. Okay, let's talk a little bit about, you know, being a startup and emerging companies. During the day, I work with emerging companies on funding and sales and marketing strategies and business development and of course, the exit. Share with the listeners, what are your biggest challenges? Do you have advice for them? Jyothi, can you start?
I'm writing a book about that. I mean, this is my ninth startup, so. everyone's different, and this one's really easy to explain the problem and how our solution is different. But the execution of it has been, as I said at the very outset, quite challenging, because it's a somewhat complicated product. It's an IP sale. So I guess the advice to people is business model is really important thing to get figured out early. When we got started, we thought we were going to build a secure processor, that we were going to take, you know, a core. Maybe because it was free, we would have started with RISC-V and put our security, you know, pixie dust in it, and be a fabless semiconductor. But it was pretty quick at the beginning for us to realize that that wasn't really the best model for what we were trying to do, and that switching to IP was the important thing. That had to all happen before you closed your seed funding. You got to get that right at the very beginning. This, of course, raising money isn't easy, and figuring out how to do that. We did it with a little bit of friends and family, and then found some very early investors. There's a long story behind that, which I won't go into. But then the next thing you've got to get right is your go-to-market strategy. So business strategy, your early funding, and then your go-to-market strategy. And of course, building your team. But just, you know, focus on those, you know, that's the block and tackle you've got to get right at the very beginning.
Yeah, that's good advice. Execution is important, and also the ability to pivot, right? You know, because sometimes the market changes, or sometimes maybe you underestimated or overestimated. But I help companies with pivots, and it's critical. You know, some companies have, I guess you call it analysis paralysis, right? They spend more time thinking about it than they actually do it. But how about you, John? Do you have some advice for the listeners?
Yes. One of the things I would just add on to what Jati was talking about is really clearly identify what is the pain point that your solution or product that you want to bring to the market solves, right? And that will help drive the rest of what you do a little bit easier, from your business strategy to your exit and so on and so forth. So one of the problems that we have been experiencing is that we have a technology that's an applique that kind of exists to enhance other products. And if folks don't understand that that product has limitations or critical vulnerabilities, then they're not open to hearing how your technology can make it better. I mean, so for us, that has been one of the challenges to our solution. So when we started out from a business standpoint, we were going to be an IP house, similar to what Jati talked about. We have quite a bit of IP. We have over 30 patents worldwide. And we thought that we would just show folks, you know, the people in OEMs and the large semis that, you know, here's the problem that you guys have, here's a solution that can solve it. And they would just license our technology from that standpoint. Well, we found out, well, they want to see this in our existing working product. So we've had to pivot in some sense to then build a system around our core IP to demonstrate its utility to other folks. And obviously, you know, that's a little bit more than we initially started. So then the fundraising to support that is different than for what we first started out. So we've had some challenges trying to get the fundraising activity to support this pivot as we move forward. But you have to stay persistent, and you have to, feel like that, that if you keep pushing, at some point people will hear your message and be open to any positive criticism you might receive to help you along the way. So that would be probably my biggest suggestion to folks that's thinking about this journey.
Faris, you have the advantage of batting cleanup.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, very hard to add stuff to what Jyoti and John said. The business plan is important, as Jyoti said, but it will change, and it will always be more optimistic than you thought it was. Your idea of your benefits, you're usually very accurate, But the pivot, if not needed in the business model, is needed in the product offering, because from a customer perspective, it's not a feature, it's not a technical spec, it's a solution, it's a reference design. You find yourself needing to do more. So take that into consideration, understand how will the customer design your benefits, not just how will you deliver a bare bones to the customer and say, here, go design with that. And all of both of these will translate into just one advice: don't run out of cash. Everything will take more money than you need. Everything will need more funding than you need. It will take you longer. Plan the runway, take the money where you can, and don't run out of cash. That's your biggest enemy.
That's good advice. It's like remodeling your house. You know, take the estimate and double it.
Well, I just, and short, I couldn't install the toilet, you know.
Yeah, you know, as an advisor myself, I really know the value of outside eyes looking in. And I really know the value of being part of an ecosystem. So maybe you can talk to me, tell the listeners a little bit about Silicon Catalyst and the in-kind partners and the ecosystem value. You know, how has Silicon Catalyst provided you value, Jyothi?
Yeah, so I got a nice quick dose of this right at the first, just when we were being brought in November of 19, and there was a room full of, I don't know, I think maybe close to 80 or so people. And, you know, we just, each of us did a 10 minute pitch, and suddenly people who were turned out to be prospective customers, people who were bankers, VCs, and just very experienced people from the semiconductor industry were all there. And so every time we turn around, you know, we find out that there's, you know, someone at Silicon Catalyst who knows someone really high up and important where we're working. And and then in terms of the in-kind partners, you've heard me talk about Arm, who is one of the in-kind partners. TSMC is, I think, one of Silicon Catalyst's flagship partners, and we're going to take advantage of getting into silicon through them. When you read about what Silicon Catalyst is all about, they're really delivering on that, which is we are in a time when there are going to be a lot more semiconductor companies than there were for the last 10 years, for sure. And that's because of IoT and needing specialized devices. The investor world, by the way, hasn't caught up, because the vast majority of investors, when I mention either the word hardware or silicon, start shaking with PTSD, and they have to go on a special list in my spreadsheet, because there's only a few that stay on the front tab, because they like hardware and silicon. So point being, there's investors now that are kind of like this and are looking at the kinds of companies that Silicon Catalyst is supporting. And so it's a very rich ecosystem for us, and a set of advisors for us.
Yeah, I go to the Silicon Catalyst meetings. You know, I'm work with them in multiple different facets, but I'm surprised you forgot to mention the food and the wine.
Yeah, there aren't very many people that provide wine.
Good wine.
That was good wine. Very good wine.
How about you, John?
Well, I'll stick on the wine subject for that. So I think that's to be attributed to Pete. Pete Rodriguez. But, you know, I've been in Silicon Catalyst for 24 months, and like Ferris, I was I'm greatly appreciative to have gotten an extension. And over that time, I have seen that not only has the number of in-kind partners grown, you know, Silicon Catalyst itself has grown, and its visibility in the industry has grown, which helps the portfolio companies. So it's a symbiotic relationship. As we do well, Silicon Catalyst does well, And as they do well, we can benefit from that. And I myself can speak, you know, for Xpree, being part of the Silicon Catalyst ecosystem has benefited us greatly. Not only we use a lot of the in-kind partners, one of which is the map. We use both MapWorks products, and we also have AWS services. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that. So, you know, so those things are coming at a, you know, minimum cost for the kinds of features that we're using it for. And that's helped us to maintain a small agile team that does good work. And if we had to pay for those services, it would have been a non-starter for us. Right. And the exposure you get when you go through these meetings and when the pandemic goes away, and we're able to meet and shake hands with folks. People are very excited, you know, to try to help you in some way, shape or fashion to get your company moving forward. And as Jati was speaking to, it's all the who's who in the semiconductor industry. And so that makes you think that, you know, you do your part. There's an avenue to get to whomever you need to get you to the next stage. And so that's one of the more comforting parts of being part of this ecosystem in the Silicon Catalyst family. Then you meet other great CEOs that you know, get to share stories. And Jati and I have had our own conversations privately and talking about what, you know, what we're trying to do and how we might help each other. So that's an added benefit as well, the camaraderie with the other CEOs.
And the wine. Yeah, you know, some of the meetings I've attended, I've seen in the audience, there are legends, semiconductor legends in the audience. I mean, it's incredible. One of the guys, John East, you know, the former CEO of Actel, he's part of this. And I just met him through the through one of the meetings. And, you know, we've actually spent quite a bit of time together. But there's some legendary people that attend these meetings, probably because of the wine. So far as you want,
John for sure appreciates the wine. I can tell you that. We wouldn't be here if it weren't for Silicon Catalyst. Period. We wouldn't be, and I'm not. It's not lip service. Our cash, our seed cash, would not have lasted through paying for EDA tools if it weren't for the Synopsys partner. We've talked a lot about ARM, and the reason we're talking about integrating MCUs and IP and customers is because we're a viable funded company that customers are talking to us about what they want to see next in addition to the current product. And the reason we are there is because of all of the partners, TSMC. I mean, I've been in established companies all my career, and you got to plan how will TSMC take you as a company, and will they have bandwidth for you? And will they have capacity for you, and will they give you attention? As a startup company, we have had stellar, absolutely stellar service from TSMC. In the capacity crunch we're having right now, whenever we wanted to do an echo fix, whenever we want to do a shuttle, whenever we want to do a tape out, a product, we're always prioritized as a startup coming through the ecosystem and given the attention. Synopsys, we wouldn't be there if it weren't for all of the support and the design flow, not just free tools, you know, we had to change our design flow from other EDA tools to Synopsys to take advantage. And now we have a paid contract with Synopsys. RF is a bitch to test without, an Advantest was huge. The consulting we got from Advantest on ultra wideband, on testing, on tester time, on load boards was massive. We needed funding. We needed venture debt. Silicon Valley Bank came through. ND Capital came through. We've met a lot of other investors. And now we talk about the advisor. We talk about the legends. You could walk up to Wally Ryans and talk to him and get some advice. You talk to John, who's on our board. He was the reason I am at Spark Microsystems. He introduced me to Spark. There isn't a single partner at Silicon Catalyst. Nick has been a tremendous champion for Spark, but I mean, Rich Curtin and Lance Bell, huge, huge marketing help. Tarun, everything. Laura really whipped me in shape when it comes to improving our message, improving how we deliver the message and how we pitch.
if you haven't talked to Rick Lazansky every time you have a term sheet or every time you get the inside story of, you know, what you should look for and what you do. And we've had multiple calls. We wouldn't be here without him. I mean, the wealth of expertise and help and in-kind partners and free money that was available is just invaluable. The model works. They had a vision. They executed it. It just works. I mean, it works. It's look at all these companies that are incubated by Silicon Catalyst. They're viable companies, and all of them are getting funded, and all of them are succeeding. It's a really great model that works.
Great content, guys. Thank you very much for your time. I think this is a good place to stop, and we'll see you again next week. That concludes our podcast. Thank you all for listening, and have a great day.